Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. President John F. Kennedy, in an address to a joint session of Congress in 1961, changed the course of history.
I believe that this nation should commit itself to achieving the goal before this decade is out of landing a man on the moon and returning him safely to the earth.
This year, the U.S. and many around the world celebrate the 50th anniversary of the first mission to the moon. We're talking about the significance of that feat today. David Aguilar is an astronomer, former director of science information for the Harvard-Smithsonian Center for Astrophysics, and author of the new book, Luna, The Science and Stories of Our Moon. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Ann.
You know, a lot of his speech that day in 1961 was really about other challenges, the Cold War not the least of which. It was only a few minutes of the speech that involved the mission to the moon. What's the significance of that now, looking back?
It was huge. And that little portion about going to the moon, it was a horrible day. It was hot. He was out in an open football stadium when Kennedy made this statement, but it really defined us as a nation, as a group of people that could accomplish something that had never been done before. We knew the Russians were hot on our heels. They were going to go. They were preparing their own lunar spaceship. So it was a moment to rise up and say, this is who we are and this is what we can do. And it caught the world by surprise.
And by catching the world by surprise, how did that work? Sometimes people are repelled by these kinds of surprise notions. How did people respond at the time?
Well, there was a small group that were very positive, but don't think that the nation jumped up and down and said, ho, we're going to the moon. They did not. And during the progress of the development of the program, there were different challenges that came about. I mean, Kennedy was told at one point, we're never going to make it to the moon by 1969, that it's going to take longer. And he knew that the congressional funding and that different things will happen to a nation and it will change in its ideals and what it wants to do. So it was a gamble, and yet we did it.
What's really amazing is that Congress came together and provided the necessary funding for it. Maybe that's just through the lens of today, right?
That is through the lens of today. There was a lot of debate. I mean, we were getting ourselves into the Vietnam War. Mm-hmm. There was Russia and the fact that we might be attacked by missiles in Cuba. There was a lot going on that we don't think about that needed funding, that needed attention. And this idea of going to the moon was wonderful, but what were we going to do with it when we got there?
Just walk on it. just
no,
walk on
think
it.
Think about that for a second. Walking on the moon is not easy. And 1/6 the gravity. This was one of the things they didn't know. Even when Neil Armstrong stepped out onto the surface of the moon, they didn't know if he was going to sink up to his knees in moon dust. And they were like kids because they hopped over the surface of the moon like rabbits. They loved it.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. 20 years ago, I'm sorry, 50 years ago on July 20th, Neil Armstrong, of course, the famous Ohio native, took the first human steps on the moon. That's what we're talking about today, the significance of that, looking back 50 years and looking ahead. My guest is David Aguilar. He's an astronomer, former director of science information for the Harvard-Smithsonian Center for Astrophysics, and author of a new book. It's titled Luna, The Science and Stories of Our Moon. And the book appears it's not uncomplicated, David Aguilar, but it does appear packaged for children. What about how children respond or the nature of youth when it comes to things like the space program?
I think they feel they have a part in it. And that's one of the reasons that got me started in writing children's books. I think adult books are easier to write than children's because you've got to be clear, you've got to get to the point, and you've got to inspire. We just found out on Jeopardy, James Holzer reads children's books. That's where he got all of his information because he said adult books are boring, but children's books, they've got to be interesting.
It's complicated though, right? How interested were people in the development of the program back in the day?
Well, it was so broad, and you had engineers with huge huge challenges, how to make these vehicles, how to fly these vehicles. You had the training of the astronauts. You had the mission to come together to build these huge rockets that could launch them there. It was massive. And yet, we still are benefiting from many of the discoveries that were made, from computers to epoxy glues, all of these things that came out of this technology push to go to the moon. We benefit from it today.
But we don't even know. I mean, epoxy glue, I didn't know that.
Super glues. Velcro had been invented by the French, but it had never been really utilized. All sorts of new technologies came about. And that's what I love about space research, any of the scientific research that we do today. The spinoffs are down the road. We forget where they came from, but it was these types of programs that do it.
As NASA, which, by the way, I think was 10 times larger just a few years later, right?
It was. It grew. We had developed so much, we realized next we had to put space stations up or a returnable vehicle that could come up and come back down, just like we see in the movies. So we moved on to bigger and more massive projects.
It's amazing the impact on culture. Something is maybe as prosaic as the Jetsons was spawned during this era.
I agree. It was everything that science fiction told us we could do. And yet here we have 7 missions and 12 human beings that did it. They walked on the moon, our next door neighbor, our constant companion in our skies. And yet this was reality. We had moved that far away from Earth.
What were the challenges?
Oh my gosh, so many challenges. We didn't know, for instance, that if we brought the lunar dust back, if it would catch on fire. We knew it had some iron in it, but we had no idea what would happen if it was exposed to oxygen. So when the astronauts brought some of the rocks and the lunar dust back into the lunar lander, they had to confine them in case they had to quickly throw them out the door if they caught fire when they turned the oxygen on. I mean, there was all sorts of challenges.
I read somewhere that for every hour on the moon, there was 1 million human hours invested in developing it and getting them there.
I hadn't heard that figure before, but it certainly would not surprise me. There were thousands and thousands of Americans involved and other countries too. Remember, Australia helped track all of our spacecraft. This was a global effort that everybody joined in towards the end in one little way or another to help out. But it was an American accomplishment.
You know, giving the relative transience of Congress, were there nips and tucks along the way when it came to funding? Were there problems? Did they have to continually convince Congress this was an important thing?
In some aspects, they did. Come on, we had Vietnam War going on. We had still competing with the Russians. Yes, there were a lot of different priorities and a lot of engineering challenges. I'll give you a funny example. Neil Armstrong had never flown a lunar lander. No human being ever had, because we don't have the same gravitational situation here on Earth. The moon is 1/6 the gravity of the Earth. You weigh 200 pounds on Earth, you're going to weigh 33 pounds on the moon. So you don't have any air to support wings to keep you into the air. You don't have propellers to support you. So he learned in simulators. He crashed the two simulators here in the desert that he tried to fly. So even when we landed that thing on the surface of the moon, it was by the seat of our pants. And I'll tell you something that really stuns me. Every time I hear and see that little video of Neil Armstrong setting down on the moon, listen very carefully to NASA control, and they say 60 seconds. And then they're talking 30 seconds, and they're talking. When Neil Armstrong sat down on the moon, I'm guessing he had no more than 10 or 12 seconds of fuel left. That's what they're telling him. Your gas tank's running out of fuel. And if he had not landed that, he would have had to press the button and they would have gone back up to the orbiter and gone home without ever stepping foot on the moon. He was about 12 seconds away of running out of fuel.
Did they know it would be cut that close?
No, they didn't, because when he came in and the crater where he wanted to land was a little bit bigger and a different angle than they had expected, so he had to fly over it. He took control and flew over that big crater and landed a little bit further away than what they had originally anticipated, and it worked.
And they had to reserve enough fuel to get back.
Well, that was already contained in the blast-off unit. That was good. That was good to go. But it was the lander that was running out of fuel.
What about what they decided to do once they were on the moon and how they used their time there? How did they decide that?
That was already set up. They already had right down almost to the minute what they should be doing. They were setting out experiments. They were curious to see if there were moonquakes. They were curious to see if it was geologically active. Of course, immediately they wanted to pick up lunar soil. And so Neil Armstrong, the first thing he did is reach down and grab a handful of soil and put it in his pocket just in case everything stopped and they had to get back and go up to the orbiter and head home. He at least had some lunar soil in his pocket. And so they were set up with all the different experiments, everything they wanted to put out there. There was a reflector that we still use today with laser beams to bounce off the moon that they set up there. So their time was taken care of, and they knew exactly what they needed to do.
Any surprises?
Well, one of the surprises was that we didn't sink up to our knees in moon dust.
They really didn't know, yeah.
That was a real plus. And look at the lunar lander. It's got those big, fat dish plates on the bottom where their legs come down in case it was going to sink in. I think we knew there wasn't going to be any air. We knew that the Earth would be spectacular, but we never realized how it would affect us as a species to see our planet from such a great distance. And one photograph taken of the Earth rising above the moon has lasted with us for 50 years. And it put into perspective of who we are, what our planet is, how beautiful it is, how different it is than the moon. And yet the moon and the Earth are constant companions. They're linked together. And they're important to one another in space and in the orbits that they manage. And the moon does affect us here on Earth. And that was a surprising connection.
Literally and figuratively.
Yes, absolutely. Poetically, musically, artistically is one particular area. But if the moon did not exist, probably you and I wouldn't be here either. The moon stabilized the rotation of the Earth. The Earth is like a crazy spinning top just before it tips over, but the moon stabilizes that spin. If not, we would have tidal waves, you know, coursing across the surface of our planet. And secondly, it creates tides. The water goes out. Sea creatures are stranded near the shore. The water comes back. They're happy again. It goes back out. But in that time period, they learn to live on land. And these are the creatures that eventually crawled out of the oceans and said, hey, the land might be a kind of cool place to live. Let's hang out here. So without the moon, you and I might not be here.
We are talking about the 50th anniversary of the landing on the moon, the first human to walk the moon. My guest is David Aguilar. He's an astronomer, former director of science information for the Harvard Smithsonian Center for Astrophysics, and author of a new book. It's called Luna, The Science and Stories of Our Moon. If you have a question or comment, give us a call. Maybe you remember where you were when Neil Armstrong set foot on the moon. Tell us what you felt about that, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. 50 years ago, on July 20th, 1969, millions of Americans and many, many others around the world watched Ohio native Neil Armstrong take the first step on the surface of the moon.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
We're talking about the significance of this feat and how space travel still matters today. Still with us is astronomer, former director of science information for the Harvard-Smithsonian Center for Astrophysics, and author of the new book, Luna, The Science and Stories of Our Moon, David Aguilar, by Skype. Also, Charles Fishman. He's a journalist and author of the new book, One Giant Leap, The Impossible Mission That Flew Us to the Moon. His 50-part series titled 50 Days to the Moon appears in the business magazine Fast Company through July 20th. Charles Fishman joins us by Skype. Welcome. I'm sorry,
Thanks
Charles
so
Fishman
for-
is by phone. Thanks.
Thanks so much for having me.
Charles Fishman, you said going to the moon is the hardest thing this country has ever done. I guess that would mean it's the hardest thing anyone's ever done.
It is unquestionably the hardest thing human beings have done outside of wartime. 410,000 people worked in America to put the astronauts on the moon, to do 11 Apollo missions. There were more people working on Apollo than were fighting in Vietnam for three of the years of the war. In fact, of course, bigger than the Panama Canal, 10 times the scale of the Panama Canal, three times the scale of the Manhattan Project, bigger even, I'm told, than the pyramids. An incredible undertaking.
Some context here. We hadn't yet orbited the Earth, right? Or had we? I mean,
when John Kennedy said in May 1961, let's go to the moon, we had exactly 15 minutes and 2 seconds of spaceflight experience. Only five of those were actually in space. No, we had not. We would not, in fact, even orbit an astronaut around the Earth for another 8 months after Kennedy said, let's go to the moon. When he said, let's go to the moon, it was impossible. Not only was it impossible, in May 1961, more than half of Americans had never even been in an airplane. He wanted them to support space travel to the moon, and most of us had never even taken an airplane trip yet.
So does that mean a lot of people poo-pooed the whole idea right off the bat?
You know, what was interesting was, in fact, right off the bat, it had overwhelming support. The larger context was the Russians were really crushing us in space. The first spaceship of any kind, Sputnik, the first animals launched into space and then recovered safely, the first astronaut to space, that was Yuri Gagarin, the first spaceflight to the moon, unmanned, the first spaceship with two astronauts, the first woman astronaut. They did everything first for years. And Kennedy said to his staff, coming in second in space is the same as losing, and we should not be losing. And so this was really a Cold War effort and a real rivalry with the Russians. And that's what got us going.
Hmm. Yeah, it was. In fact, that first speech he gave, we mentioned earlier, most of it revolved around Cold War aspirations.
I'm sorry I didn't hear earlier, but it was about a 45, 47 minute speech, and only 8 minutes of it was about going to the moon. And the moon part came at the very end. I had to listen to 30 minutes of talk about Cold War programs the next day. The Washington Post and the New York Times ran stories saying Congress wants to give the president anything he wants. There was a wonderful moment from literally a month earlier, right after Yuri Gagarin became the first astronaut. There were congressional hearings the next day. In those days, they sometimes moved quickly, like, why are they in space and we aren't? And a congressman said to the head of NASA, Mr. Webb, tell me how much money you need, and we will give it to you.
And what did it end up?
Happen?
What did? Yeah, exactly. What did it end up costing?
You know, it was actually not that expensive. That's a little unconventional view. All in, going to the moon cost $19.4 billion in the 1960s. That's the actual dollars spent in the years they were spent added up. No, not inflation adjusted. Mm-hmm. What's $19.4 billion? There were two individual years of the Vietnam War, that cost more than $19.4 billion. 2 years of the 10-year war that cost more than the entire race to the moon. So in that context, in fact, while we were going to the moon, call it $20 billion, Americans spent $40 billion on cigarettes. So we could afford it. Whether it was a good use of money is a different question, but we could certainly afford it. And you know what? We got our money's worth. We said we wanted to go to the moon, and we did.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Yes, we are talking about the moon and the first person to walk on the moon. The 50th anniversary of that moment occurs on July 20th, 2019. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. And Lisa in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Lisa.
Hi. I just wanted to share that I was 10 years old when this happened in the summer, but the following year I was in fifth grade, and certainly more Apollo missions came, and we would see the splashdowns. You know, we'd put the television on in the classroom, and we would watch. And then the amazing part was, years later, I became a fifth grade teacher, and I was teaching about this, and the kids really didn't understand that it was on the top of, the men were on this little capsule at the top of the rocket, and that they splashed down in an ocean. They were so used to gliders just coming down at an airport. So it was just funny, the change of time, but also the lack of knowledge that they had. You know, it was, of course they wouldn't know, but I think it's important that all of us understand what a process that really was, how little they were at the top of that rocket.
How little they were. Right. Thank you, Lisa, for that call.
Thank you.
David Aguilar, how much did people know at the time about what was going on with the mission to the moon?
Well, there were activities and there were reports. It, as far as coming together, there would be tests. We would be sending astronauts up. We'd be looking at new capsules coming out. It was a long process. So consequently, there were other things going on that also caught our attention. And taking a look at this, I would say it was pretty quiet for a while until we really started launching astronauts out there and seeing the results and realizing we really were going to the moon.
Hmm. Charles Fishman, your thoughts about that?
Well, you know, once the Apollo mission started, there was the terrible fire in January 1967. Three Apollo astronauts were in a capsule. Mm. They were on top of a rocket. They were rehearsing for a launch that would have happened a month later. Then, after the fire, those three astronauts unfortunately died, Grissom, Chafee, and White. It took NASA almost 2 years to get back into space. But once the Apollo mission started in the fall of 1968, they came almost every 8 weeks, almost between 7 and 8 weeks, one right after another, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11. And then there was a little gap before 12. We landed on the moon twice in 1969. And once the missions cranked up, I think the publicity in modern terms would be the equivalent of the Olympics. It was just, I think really once they got going, it was kind of immersion. There was publicity everywhere. A tiny little indicator on the day after the moon landing. So there was no internet, of course. So you got your press coverage the day after things happened, except for watching the TV news. So the moon landing was July 20th, 1969. In the July 21st, 1969 New York Times, the entire first section of the newspaper was nothing but coverage of the moon landing, 18 full pages, including the New York Times had a page of poems inspired by the moon landing. So the publicity was a little crazy once things got underway.
Let's see. Alice in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Alice.
Hi, Ann. So I was calling to tell about my experience with respect to the moon landing.
Uh-huh.
My then husband and I were in Florida and ready to come back home, so we decided that we were going to go to watch the liftoff. And I don't remember the name of the little town, but it was totally jammed. It's right across from across the bay, totally jammed with people cars all over. Everybody's sleeping in their cars, including us, or on the hood. Lots of mosquitoes. Saw the lift off the next morning, and then we drove home. We got to our apartment in Columbus, which was up a little hill, and we just parked the car, ran up the hill, ran into the apartment, turned on the TV in time to see Neil Armstrong exit Apollo 11. It was so cool.
Tell us what it was like. What was the physical feeling when you watched the launch? Did it really hit you hard physically? Could you hear it?
It was just beautiful. No, we couldn't. We could not. Well, I don't remember, but I remember it being just beautiful, really gorgeous. And everyone in the crowd, I mean, you want to talk crowded. This was crowded.
What town
and everyone was cheering.
Alice can't remember the name of the town. Charles Fishman?
Cape Canaveral. It was probably Cape Canaveral. She was out across from the Banana River.
Okay.
Cocoa
Beach.
Cocoa Beach.
Yeah.
Sure.
Of I Dream of Jeannie fame, of course. Alice, thanks a lot for that memory. I remember I was a kid and my dad said, everybody get in here right now. And we had to sit in front of the TV and watch him walk on the moon. And it was pretty exciting. But my dad was very avid. Was there a sense about who got into this the most, or was it sort of like an everybody got into it thing? Charles Fishman?
Well, there were a million people with Alice in within a few miles of the launch. A million people drove there to watch.
Wow.
94% of American households watched the moonwalk, which happened at about 11 o'clock on July 20th. So that's pretty much everybody. And 600 million people worldwide. It was only blocked. The moon landing and the moonwalk were only blocked in a few countries in the world: the Russians, the Soviet Union, Communist China, as it was called in those days, and North Korea prevented their people from watching. But literally everywhere else, ABC News, it was 1969, so this was kind of remarkable, set up huge TV screens in Central Park, and there was a huge moonwatch party right there in Central Park for people.
My husband said that he was impressed, that he was surprised that after when the astronauts returned, that they did a worldwide tour, and that people around the world were ecstatic about this. David Aguilar?
Well, this was an accomplishment that had never happened before. It was a vision that grew. Everybody embraced it. And oddly enough, it was the Americans who went to the moon, but it was the world that cheered it on and felt that they were a major part of it. This was the human species leaving its planet and going someplace that it had never been before. And it's the spirit of who we are. And I think the world globally shared in it.
Let's see. Bill in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Bill.
Hi, Ann. Tremendous show. Big fan of your show.
Thank you.
I was between fourth and fifth grade that summer. I'm wearing a NASA T-shirt right now because the spirit of accomplishing putting man on the moon and Neil Armstrong, and I had a chance to meet him when I was in high school, and it was one of the seminal great moments of my life because I really feel like he had the right stuff. When he put that lunar lander down there with literally seconds to go. I mean, I've been in the Kennedy Space Center and they played the film with the video and the whole thing. It's moving. But back then we felt like we could do anything in the United States, in the world. We could conquer cancer. We could do anything because of the spirit that of President Kennedy's leadership empowered us to pursue. And I will tell you that the world watched that. The world was united behind us. I guess the question I have for your two guests, Anne, is we were very united then. I think I'm optimistic we can be united again. Some people talk about going back to the moon. I'm not a big fan of that. I'm more of a fan of going to Mars, and they talk about it like a way station. Well, it seems to me like Earth would be a better way station than some satellite orbiting moon. I'd like to get your guest perspective on the next logical objective, if we could cultivate some unity in our country for a common purpose. I vote for Mars.
Okay. Charles Fishman, what do you think?
Well, I think I have a couple of reactions. One is it's important to appreciate that the moon, the race to the moon in the 60s had a unifying element, but that was an even more divisive time than now. 1968 and 1969 were as fractured a time in the politics of the United States as any time since the Civil War. Protests, two national leaders gunned down, literally assassinated, college campuses taken over, the incredible division around the Vietnam War. So going to the moon was kind of a ribbon, a thread through that, and it did unify us, but it was not a unified time. And so I think that's important. The other thing is, I think it's really important. That was an incredible accomplishment. Ordinary Americans did it, right? The astronauts are sort of the tip of the spear, so to speak. They are the personality. But the work was done back here on Earth by ordinary Americans. So the caller is exactly right. We were asked to do something extraordinary, and we did it. But you know what? Americans went on to create Apple and Google and Intel and Microsoft. Americans decoded the genome. Americans invented the internet. And so I don't think that the spirit of America that went to the moon is in any way gone. I think, in fact, in many ways, we're a better country than we were in 1969 in lots and lots of ways. I think the lesson for me from spending 4 years immersed in this is that Americans like to be asked to do hard things. We like to be told something's impossible and then show that it was, in fact, possible after all. And so for me, I came away very optimistic, and optimistic in the sense that if we have leaders who say, this is really hard, but it's important, join us and do it, we will. And the politics of the time won't matter. It didn't matter which side of the Vietnam War you were on if you were working to send those astronauts to the moon.
David Aguilar, what about the issue of using the moon as a stop-off point versus just going straight from the from Earth to Mars?
It makes perfect sense. Look at it this way. If you got some camping gear and you decide that you're going to go camping for the very first time in your life in Antarctica, I would start in my backyard first. I'd figure it out, how the tent goes up, how I get water, how everything works before I pack it all up and head to a land that could be pretty unforgiving. The moon is 2 days away, 2.5 days away with some of the new spacecraft. Mars is months and months and months. A round trip to Mars can be up to 2 years long. And so consequently, if something goes wrong, you need to come home, you need new supplies, the moon's a place where we try it out. But I want to say something else, and Charles brought up a good point about how the world felt about it and what it says for America as a leader, as a visionary, as a country who can get this done. Right now, today, I saw that the Indian spacecraft to the moon had been held up. They're going to launch. The Japanese have been there. The Chinese have been there. The Russians want to go back. They realize that this is the stepping stones to the rest of our solar system. And so we need to do it. We need to go back. We need to establish how we live in space, how we explore, because the next time somebody goes into outer space and it happens to be Mars, we're going to see this global coverage all over again, a most exciting time. And there's something about 20% of the human species that contains what we call the wandering gene, the DRD4 gene, that makes us explore. Hmm. This is part of who we are. We can't help it.
Bill, thanks for that call, and I want to squeeze one more in from Scott in Canal Winchester. Hi, Scott.
Hi. I was wondering if you guys could explain the phenomenon that some people believe that the whole moon landing was a hoax and that it was staged in a studio in Hollywood. And why would somebody believe that?
Yeah, where did the hoax culture come from? Charles Fishman?
Well, I think there's always been a certain amount of skepticism about the federal government or any government and what they're up to and what they claim. I don't really want to dignify the hoax conversation too much. There are two the two things that I sort of think about talking about the hoax. The first is, this was a race. When Armstrong and Aldrin, the first people to land on the moon, and Collins got to the moon, there was a Soviet unmanned probe in orbit already, Luna 15. The job of Luna 15 was to drop down and land on the moon, grab moon rocks and moon dirt, and literally blast off and race back to the Soviet Union before Collins and Aldrin and Armstrong could get back with their rocks, so that the Soviet Union could at least be on stage, so they could say, look, we got moon rocks before the Americans, and we didn't even need to send people. Now, Luna 15 ended up crashing. It did not succeed, although a sister craft did succeed a year later. This was not a rivalry. This was a battle. The Soviets and the Americans had nuclear weapons pointed at each other. If we had been faking, the Russians would have outed us in the blink of an eye, and they not only would have told the world, they would have told the world with joy and deep satisfaction they're faking. But just as important, it's just disrespectful. 500,000 Americans worked furiously with incredible energy and creativity to do something that was really hard. The idea that it's made up is just ridiculous, but it's also disrespectful to those people. So I... You know, 14% of Americans today don't know the name of the vice president. So people live in whatever world they want to live in. I don't choose to live in the world where this is made up, because the real world is a much more interesting and inspiring and vivid place.
Scott, thanks a lot for that call. We are going to take a quick break. We'll continue our conversation about the 50th anniversary of the first steps on the moon. My guest, you just heard, David Aguilar, astronomer, former director of science information for the Harvard Smithsonian Center for Astrophysics, and author of a new book called Luna, The Science and Stories of Our Moon. Also with us, Charles Fishman. He's a journalist and author of the new book, One Giant Leap, The Impossible Mission That Flew Us to the Moon. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking about the significance of the 1969 moon landing and why space travel still matters today. Still with us by Skype, astronomer, former director of science information for the Harvard Smithsonian Center for Astrophysics, and author of a new book called Luna, The Science and Stories of Our Moon, David Aguilar. Also is journalist and author of the new book, One Giant Leap, The Impossible Mission That Flew Us to the Moon, Charles Fishman. The Northwest Ohio city of Wapakoneta, the hometown of astronaut Neil Armstrong, was devoted the year to celebrate the 50th anniversary of the moon landing. And coming up, we're going to hear from the chair of the 2019 Celebration Committee in Wapakoneta. But first, I wanted to talk, David and Charles, a little bit more about the experience. And Charles Fishman, the idea of technology, just our, the very essence of what it meant to us as a society, as a culture, changed because of the space program. How so?
Yeah, you know, in 1961, when Kennedy said, let's go to the moon, there was no real idea in the popular culture, in everyday life, of technology. In fact, the word wasn't used that way. It was used mostly to refer to military technology, to atomic weapons. We had lots of gadgets, mostly home appliances, but there was no idea of a TV or a radio as technology. And what's interesting is that during the race to the moon, we not only saw computers in use, we saw computers being used for a non-military purpose and actually kind of the hardest thing you could imagine doing with them, right? We have a decade of people sitting at consoles and mission control using computers to fly spaceships and then to fly spaceships to the moon. And so by the end of the moon mission, by the early 1970s, there was this whole new concept that computers were useful. That, oh, that's a tool you might use for something besides launching weapons. And they were completely reliable,
and they were something that was accessible. Ordinary people could use them. Now that, you know, we would have our iPhones and our word processors and our spreadsheets if we hadn't gone to the moon, but going to the moon changed the attitude. It really created an openness in American culture. And there were all these, there was, you know, the Jetsons, it was Lost in Space, there was Star Trek. Those weren't accidents of the culture. There were no space TV shows in the 50s. And in all those shows, you know, in the Jetsons, the computers walk the dog and make lunch and do all kinds of things. They were sort of hand in hand with going to the moon, changing the cultural attitude about what role computers could play and what we might hope to expect from them eventually.
And, you know, when we landed on the moon, I guess I'm thinking about the memories of the landing. And I don't know if you two remember this. What were they called? Moonstick? Or no, space sticks. There were other parts of our culture that capitalized on the technology or the experience of it. You know, Tang, the things we ate changed, that sort of thing. And David Aguilar, I mean, it's just, it's kind of mind-boggling when you think about it. What if, you know, if someone, there's a movie out now about what if nobody knew about the Beatles, and I'm wondering, what if nobody knew about the moon?
You mean if nobody knew about landing on the moon?
Yeah,
or going
it never,
moon?
I guess maybe it never happened or they don't remember it happening.
Well, I'm sure there are some people out there that still are not aware that we went to the moon. and they may question why you would want to go to the moon, because it certainly doesn't look like any place here on Earth. But I can't imagine this seems now to be a legend. It's part of who we are. It's part of America. It's part of that era. It was a crazy era with wars, with mm-hmm. rock and roll suddenly appearing at the very same time, a new generation, the richest, youngest, most educated generation that ever lived on the planet Earth coming out of the United States, and the technology, the realization that we could do it. If we put our mind to it, if we put our energies to it, there wasn't anything we might not be able to do. This was a very can-do attitude during this time period. Again, you know, covered with strife and all different situations going on within the countries. But it was a horrible, wonderful time for technology and human beings and showing what we're capable of doing.
Rachel Barber is the chair of the 2019 Celebration Committee in Wapakoneta, of course, the hometown of astronaut Neil Armstrong. She joins us as well. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having me.
Rachel Barber, how do you even conceive a celebration that lasts a year in Wapakoneta to remember this time in history?
Well, we started planning in August of 2016 and brought a lot of people from the community to the table. So the newspaper, the Economic Development Council and Chamber, the library, the Y, all kinds of folks, and just started brainstorming for a while and tried to figure out what we could actually pull off. And we, first of all, we became aware that, you know, we couldn't do it in any 3 or 4 day format. That wouldn't do justice to all the ways we wanted to celebrate. And I think another of our emphases was that we wanted to make sure that we brought everybody to the table. So even if you didn't consider yourself a space geek, how could we interest you in this? How could we help you understand this story better from your perspective? So then we start thinking about what concerts can we have? What speakers can we bring in? Just what activities? So we have a cooking contest and a flower garden contest, trying to see who can make a sculptural use of the moonflowers, which grow on trellises, and talk about the 60s, you know, which I've just heard you all talking about, you know, mm-hmm. the context of how we went to the moon and what else was going on nationally and internationally, so that everybody would feel like they had a reason to be involved. We actually had the premiere of a public television documentary here on Saturday, where a number of Mr. Armstrong's classmates and childhood friends were interviewed, and there were, I would say, 500 people there who came from the community, and they brought their kids and they brought their families, and it was preceded by a baritone duet. Well, why a baritone duet? Because that was another of Mr. Armstrong's interests. And so we're just trying to give people a way to plug into this. So We're kind of ambitious. We had the parade yesterday. I'm a little tired from that, but we have almost a week's worth of celebrating left to go.
Charles Fishman, why Neil Armstrong?
What a great question. Before I get to that, let me just add one thing. Ohio played this huge role with Neil Armstrong. There's another important role. There was a huge vehicle, the largest land vehicle ever created, transported the entire Saturn V rocket from the assembly building to the launch pad. It was called the Crawler. They built two of them, and it was made in Marion, Ohio, by the Marion Power Company. It only moved 1 mile an hour, and it carried 14 million pounds, and it is actually still in use. It moved all of the Saturn rockets, then it moved all the space shuttles, and it is the only big piece of Apollo technology still in use. Came from Ohio, sort of exactly the opposite role of Neil Armstrong, a kind of quiet giant that didn't get a lot of attention, grinding along. But, you know, Neil Armstrong in some ways was the perfect person, calm, thoughtful, a great wry sense of humor, not a self-promoter. He turned out to be, in that sense, perfect. I think his legacy is a tiny bit complicated because I don't think he enjoyed the attention afterward.
Right.
I don't. He seemed to. He handled it all well and was great. He did everything that was asked of him, but he didn't revel in it. And so in fact, the personality they wanted at the moment may not have been the perfect personality for afterward from the point of view of his own life.
Yeah. Rachel Barber.
Why Neil Armstrong?
Well, in retrospect, looking at Neil Armstrong, I once called him in an article for the Toledo Blade, the Greta Garbo of the Apollo program, and he just wanted to be alone in the end.
Well, I don't think he wanted to be alone. He liked his family. He came back and kept in touch with his school friends, his friends not only from here, but from Purdue and people in the space program.
Mm-hmm.
But I think he wanted to do that in the way we all want to do it. You know, we don't want, if I go to visit my friends, I don't put out a press release. And and people now, I think we have a totally different understanding of what celebrity is and what heroism is. And we know how many people put themselves out there as celebrities who have done nothing. I would say they've done nothing. Maybe they promoted a fashion line or something, a reality TV show. But he was a very focused person, and we see that, and once he decided that he wanted to be a pilot, he wanted to be involved in the design of airplanes. That's, as a young man, that's what he really thought he was going to do, was help design airplanes. He just became very focused on that. The folks who know him from his days at the drugstore where he worked after school, they say, he didn't read the Marvel comics. He read aviation magazines. And he made 40 cents an hour there to pay for his $9 an hour flight lesson. So he was just so focused on it.
A lot of history about Neil Armstrong. You can learn more about it. There is a year-long celebration in Wapakoneta, his hometown. That's Rachel Barber. She's chair of the 2019 Celebration Committee in Wapakoneta. We'll have a link to more about what's going to be happening in Wapakoneta this year at our website at WOSU.org. Rachel Barber, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
And also David Aguilar, astronomer, former director of the Science Information for Harvard Smithsonian Center for Astrophysics. And his new book is titled Luna, The Science and Stories of Our Moon. Thank you for joining us today.
You're welcome, Anne.
Charles Fishman is a journalist and author of the new book, One Giant Leap, The Impossible Mission That Flew Us to the Moon. He's also has a 50-part series out there titled 50 Days to the Moon. It appears in the business magazine Fast Company through July 20th. And we'll have a link to all of those as well on our website. Charles Fishman, thank you so much for your time today.
Good conversation. Thank you.
And that's it. Thank you so much for your attention. Have a great day. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.